Pacific Lutheran University. I'm with a program there. Actually, I work for a group called American Cultural Exchange, which I guess you could say contracts to PLU to do the teaching of foreign students. The reason I'm doing these sessions on the Middle East and on Islam is that I did the same kind of work in Saudi Arabia for 5 years at King Fahd University of Petroleum and Minerals in Dhahran. And I think Dhahran is known to most people now as being on the East Coast, and it was the center of much of the military activity, and also the city that was hit, that one barracks was hit by a Scud missile there. Very close, by the way, to a shopping center we used to go to. We were there from 1983 to 88 and left then in the summer of 88. All the time that we were there, there was a Gulf War between Iran and Iraq. We came to Holden in 86 and talked about that, and particularly about the Shiite-Sunni division, which was key at that time because the Shiites and the Sunnis were represented by Iran and Iraq, and was a key cause of that war. So, earlier this week, I talked about Islam, its beginnings. Muhammad, born in 570 AD, died in 632. He was a charismatic, obviously gifted person, a poet, a political leader, a lawgiver, a judge, was able to bring to the Arabian peoples, people who before that time had a sense only of tribal religions and a mix of different religions imported from different regions of the world, and was able to pull that together believed that he received this tremendous revelation which resulted in the book called the Holy Quran, which we have here written in Arabic. And this is a translation. A whole new presentation of what we have come to know as biblical history of the region. I want to focus today particularly on the Quran as it relates to Jesus, but the Quran also is a rewriting of, I shouldn't say rewriting, representation of the history that we know as it relates to a lot of biblical history, particularly Father Abraham. The Muslims claim Abraham as the progenitor of their religion, coming with Ishmael, not Isaac, to Mecca, building the Kaaba as the central shrine and the place to which all Muslims are required to go during their lifetime as one of the five pillars of Islam. So, as I said today, I wanted to focus on what they have to say about Jesus. Just very quickly, though, in the second session, I looked at, very quickly, 13 centuries or so of Islamic history, dating from the time of Muhammad's death up until the present time, and all the factors leading into and contributing to the complexity that was the Gulf War and still is the Gulf War situation, I think. And one of the things that I pointed out that I want to emphasize again was, to put it very simply, and for purposes of an hour's presentation, I think it's useful, is that in Christianity, I think the struggle is the emphasis in Western civilization has become one of focusing on reason and still trying to keep faith in things that are unseen, the things that we believe in because of our hearts or our spirits. In Islam, I think you can change that balance around, and theirs is one of a society that has a perspective first of faith and then of reason. So if reason doesn't agree with faith, faith wins. Whereas in the West, it's often the other way, at least in the powers that control the West now. And I think the example and the change for us came through the for Western civilization, that is, came in passing through the Middle Ages into the age of the Renaissance and Enlightenment, the age of reason, the dominance of the church and of dogmatic presentation of facts subsided, and sciences and other areas took over. And again, it's a very simplistic presentation, and I'm not sure it would hold up. But for Islam, it has tended to be anyway. And this doesn't hold true for all Islamic peoples, of course, but the way that I saw it practiced is that what you believe, first of all, holds true over anything else. And it's sometimes that's admirable. Muslims are certainly a lot more faithful people, a lot more faithful than I was in meeting them at times. I mean, they're willing to believe the promises in the Quran and the nature of God and how God works in their lives and all of those essentials without having to hold it up to question. But to us it seems, or to me anyway, it seemed like it sometimes didn't hold water. But again, I think that comes from a different emphasis in Christianity too. And a key verse in this for us is when Jesus is asked, should we pay taxes unto Caesar? Jesus answers, give unto Caesar what is Caesar, and give unto God what is God's. And it was a sort of a recognition that there is a secular realm in life, a realm that is separate. And in Islam, there is not that division at all. There is no division between politics and religion, between church and state. The Quran and the Hadith, the treasury of sayings from Muhammad, form the basis of their legal code, the Sharia law code. And in some ways, that's kind of stuck in the 14th century, and they have a hard time to know what to do with, as we do often, but they rely on that primarily to try to interpret. They have a hard time with things like bioethics and even stuff like, now seems to be commonplace technology like the radio. When the radio was first introduced in Saudi Arabia in the 30s, the king of Saudi Arabia was a rather wily character. He knew that automatically it would be rejected as being a new device, seen as the devil's playground sort of concept by the religious conservatives who had a lot of power and whom he used also in order to establish his power. So when he first transmitted on the radio, he transmitted from Jeddah on the west coast to Mecca, and he read the Quran over the radio. Thus, a device that's used to transmit the word of God cannot be an instrument of the devil. And that sort of balancing has continued, and this tenuous balance that Saudi Arabia has continued with now up until the present of trying to introduce new technology, new medicine, new roads, education for women, and so on, and somehow balancing that with tradition. And I've been thinking about this in terms of a lot of people's concerns, especially about the role of women, which is certainly valid. I mean, I would not defend the Saudis at all in how they treat women, except within the context of their own history and culture and where they're coming from and the realization that the Saudis have done, despite a lot of game playing and the world politics and so on, they're to be admired for the fact that they have held it together somehow, and there has been advancement for all people on some level or another. I would like to see more advancement in other areas. But, you know, I look at other countries that have been given wealth. Say Nigeria, for example, a tremendous oil producer. And they've ended up in internal strife and civil war and famine and all sorts of things. And somehow the Saudis, at least up until this time, managed to hold it together. Now, maybe we're going to get into more and more Gulf War situations in which that kind of balance will not be possible. But despite all our criticisms of them, there is a sense of holding it together. Okay, So we talked about that then, and of America getting involved in there, and how it was ironic that America, which was the in our Constitution, in our Declaration of Independence, the defender of freedom and liberty, somehow now taking on the mantle of the imperialists who have left the Middle East, of Britain and of France, and defending some of these kingdoms and so on. And it's not only, of course, irony in the Middle East, but can be an irony, has been an irony in other parts of the world. So that's kind of what I've talked about so far. And now I'd just like to take a look at some views that they have, particularly of Jesus. And I want to start, though, with the views that were held of Jesus at the time of Muhammad, to give you a kind of sense of the confusion that he was born into, in the sense of who this person Jesus Christ was. Because the one thing, not the one thing, but one thing that is done for us, certainly with Islam, is that it makes us really question who Jesus was for us, for everybody. Was he human? Was he divine? Was he both? Was he a prophet? Was he only a man? Was he misdirected? Was he misinterpreted? Was he misrepresented in the Gospels and in the Epistle of Paul? And Muslims bring a lot of this into question through their own viewing of the events of biblical times. At the time that Muhammad was born, there were dissident Christian sects. We hadn't quite decided in the mainstream of the church exactly who Jesus was in the centuries following him. I mean, there was a mainstream, but there were other ideas too. One group was the Arians, apparently. And this is in a book, by the way. I'm supposed to promote these books because I asked them to be bought for the bookstore. And I find it quite useful. Concise History of the Middle East. And another one that's much less expensive is called Understanding Islam. I think it's a $5 book up there. Good book. The Arians argued that Christ was only a man. Though divinely inspired and sired, was still a man, not equivalent to God. And that view was decided to be a heresy at the Council of Nicaea, held in 325. And Arianism became a heresy, and its followers were persecuted as if they had been traitors to the Roman Empire. Okay, another group was the Nestorians, centering in Paul's hometown, Antioch. They believed that Christ was two distinct persons, divine and human. And I'm not sure how that worked out. It's a very succinct presentation of it here. Divine and human, closely and inseparably joined. And the church council in Ephesus condemned this view in 430. And thus the Nestorians were sent out and persecuted and distributed throughout Persia, Central Asia, India, China, and even southern France. Another group, the Monophysites, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, had another opposite view about Christ, that he was wholly divine. And they were centered in Alexandria, closer to Saudi and Mecca. And their followers went out through Egypt, Syria, and Armenia. The Egyptian Monophysites called themselves Copts, and I assume that's still the Coptic Church, I'm not sure. And this also was suppressed until a final view of Christ had come out. I suppose there's ever a final view, but a mainstream one anyway. So into this world of confusion about who Jesus was came Muhammad, He had some exposure to Christians before his revelations. He was a trader. He had gone to Jerusalem, or Damascus anyway, and had met, you know, a variety, and I'm sure in the oral traditions and the history as it is in the Middle East, they sit down, they talk, they enjoy tea and other coffee or whatever, and they discuss, and Muhammad certainly would have heard about Jesus, this person Jesus, and about the Christians and about the Jews. Okay, I want to pass this around. I know this isn't a commonly done thing, but this is, let me just make sure I get my, okay, here it is. Pass them around, I'm not sure there's enough. This is a sheet, not prepared by me, but by a woman, and I'm sorry I don't have her name, who is a teacher at LBI, Lutheran Bible Institute. And I basically lifted this without giving her credit, because I didn't write down her name when she presented at my church. But I thought she had put a lot of this together. Oh, there's three pages to it, I'm sorry. And so that's one copy. Are there enough? I didn't think there'd be this many people. Maybe you can share. You already are sharing. We can maybe put a copy of this afterwards in the resource room if anybody wants to copy it. Okay. Just wanted to go through some of these things about how the Muslims look at the gospel. They recognize four holy books: the Law of Moses, the Psalms of David, the Gospel of Christ, and the Quran. Jews and Christians are called people of a book. This is a common term used to refer to Jews and Christians, and it's supposed to be a term of respect and honor, and it is used in that way. How it's actually practiced in reality is sometimes not so honoring, as we found out in Saudi Arabia, where no other practice of religion was allowed, or discussion of another religion was not allowed. And they believe that these holy books set the stage for the coming of Christ, for the coming of Muhammad as the last prophet. And that is the fulfillment of God's revelation to the world. I won't read through all of this. I trust that you can. So in that sense of Jesus coming and being a prophet in the tradition of the Old Testament prophets, and coming to call his people to a relationship with God, and coming to restore that religion which they feel had been corrupted by the powers in Israel at that time, or in Palestine at that time, they have no problems with that whatsoever. The problems that they have are listed here. The first problem that they have is that in the gospel there is no mention of Muhammad, which to us seems fair, since that's not part of our religion. But you have to understand that they're looking at it from a whole different perspective. You know, I mean, we really are people of faith too. We take Jesus as our leader, as God's revelation to us, as divine, as the Son of God. And we base our whole perspective on that understanding. Now, if he was just another man, that changes a lot of things. That changes everything, of course. The Muslims, starting from a whole different point, say, no, Jesus was not divine. Muhammad was the last prophet, and what Muhammad had to say about Jesus is the last word. Then you have a whole different starting point and a whole different presentation. And I think whether we agree with it or not, we have to try to come to terms with it. For centuries, the Christian church has been fighting Islam as a Christian heresy. That was the argument used in the Crusades. And thousands, probably millions of people's lives were lost, blood was shed, and civilization pitted against civilization during the process of the Crusades and subsequent persecution, because of this view that that Islam was a Christian heresy. And we may still believe that it's a misrepresentation of the truth, but I think we owe it to them and to global understanding to try to see how they view it. Okay, so the Quran says nothing about Jesus, per se. I was going to read from, let me see if I can find a section here that I was looking at. And this is a verse about Jesus. And remember, Jesus, the son of Mary, said, O children of Israel, I am the apostle of God, sent to you. Sounds pretty good so far. Confirming the law which came before me and giving glad tidings of an apostle to come after me, Muhammad, whose name shall be Ahmed, or Muhammad. But when he came to them with clear signs, meaning when Muhammad came to them with clear signs, they said, this is evident sorcery. So this is a commentary upon the Christians at the time. Who doth greater wrong than one who invents falsehood against God, even as he is being invited to Islam, and God guides not those who do wrong? So this is a word against Christians who rejected Muhammad. Then. So then the first objection, the primary objection, then, is that there is no prophecy of Muhammad and there is a rejection of him. Okay, the second thing then, point number two down here, is why is Jesus called in the gospel records Son of God when the Quran so clearly says God begets not nor was begotten, neither was there anyone like him? It's degrading to call to God to call him Father as though he got married. Okay, so this, again, is, I think, tells us, too, of the literal mindset there of the of Islam, where you're using the word father in a literal sense. All right, and they see this as very much an insult on the nature of God. A third thing is they object to the record of Jesus dying on the cross and the resurrection. They say that there was one like him who died on the cross, but not Jesus himself. In a little book called Jesus, Prophet of Islam, which I picked up in Saudi Arabia when I was there, it elaborates on this. And, let's see quickly if I can find this. They go on and on about here about a description of Jesus, and they quote a Roman official describing him, and then a Muslim description of someone else. He had nut brown hair. This is the Roman description, and smooth down to the ears, forming soft curls flowing to his shoulders. The other tradition says he was a ruddy man inclined to white, did not have long hair, never anointed his head, used to walk barefooted, took no house nor adornment nor goods nor clothes nor provisions except his day's food. His head was disheveled and his face was small. He was an ascetic in this world, longing for the next world and eager for the worship of Allah. So this is their description of Jesus, and it's not the Jesus that we've come to know, and certainly not the picture of, you know, the Jesus with the long hair and the curly beard that is described by the Roman official. So they say that one like him was killed and that the gospel record of the resurrection is false. Okay. And that's backed up by what's in the Quran. Let's see if I have noted that. Some of these, yes. They die when they know what I use for a bookmarker here. It was the closest thing. They said that in boast, we killed Christ Jesus, the Son of Mary, the Apostle of God, but they killed him not, nor crucified him, but so it was made to appear to them, and those who differ therein are full of doubts, with no certain knowledge, but only conjecture to follow, for of a surety they killed him not. Nay, God raised him up unto himself, and God is exalted in power wise. So their sense is that Jesus was resurrected, but he didn't have to go through death first. I mean, he was resurrected in the same way as Moses or Elijah, as a prophet, and brought up to God. So not resurrected from death, I guess I shouldn't say that, but elevated as Moses was. Okay, they also object to the idea, point C here on the second page, of the Holy Book having four Gospels and other books that Jesus did not dictate in the Bible. They have a particular problem with Paul. Paul, of course, in a very Western philosophical manner, coming from the Greeks who he was ministering to, presented Christ and Christianity in a logical point-by-point way as we don't find in the Gospels. And they have a real problem with that. They say that Paul was acting more out of his own self, trying to elevate himself. He was not there, of course, and did not know Jesus one-to-one during Jesus' lifetime, and that he corrupted Christianity and tried to bring it as a political force, and the real problem they have then there is with Paul. Okay, another problem then, and one of the main problems is Jesus being, or the God being of three parts, which is similar to the first problem I mentioned here of God begetting his Son. Let me see if I can find this here. And behold, God will say, O Jesus, the Son of Mary, didst thou say unto men, worship me and my mother, as gods and degradation of God? He will say, glory to thee. Never could I say what I had no right to say. Had I said such a thing, thou wouldst indeed have known it. Thou knowest what is in my heart, though I know not what is in thine. For thou knowest in full all that is hidden. So, here specifically God is saying to Jesus, God being separate from Jesus, that he never would have said that Jesus would be the same as he was. And finally, on this point, one of the last surahs here, he is God, the one and only, God the eternal, absolute. He begetteth not, nor is begotten, and there is none like unto him. So the Quran is quite clear that Jesus was not divine, and this is one of the main divisions we have. Okay, so that's a presentation of the differences between Islam and Christianity. Similarities are at the bottom of this page. There's some information in the middle that I'm going to skip over. At the bottom of page 2, similarities of things that we have between Muslims and Christians. What it teaches about God. He is one, the one, and the only God. Monotheism. A significant point, and Christianity, Judaism, and Islam are the three monotheistic religions in the world, although Hindus would object to that. They say that they really are monotheistic, although it seems difficult for us to see that. Anyway, there certainly is that sense in these three religions, particularly in Islam and Judaism, and other religions have a hard time seeing. And Muslims aren't the only one. I remember talking to a Hindu in India saying, but you really have more than... Well, let me back up a little bit. I said to to him, it seems like you have many, many gods. You know, there's Vishnu and all the other gods in the temples and so on. And he said, no, no, we have only one God, just many representations of that God in Hinduism. And same as in Christianity, you have one God, but different representations of the one God, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. you get into interesting conversations when you start comparing religions. In Islam, the concentration is certainly on the oneness of God. And as I said earlier in the week, I think that's one of its appeals to people around the world, is that it's a very straightforward, simple thing. There is one. This is very important, and it's continually stressed. He has 99 beautiful names from the Quran, concepts we would confirm, except these of being proud, subtle, and disconcerting. He is the God who speaks and reveals his will to people. So he's not just a God out there somewhere, a deistic concept of God, but he cares about his people and reveals his will to people. He sent many prophets to his people, and they recognize the prophets of the Old Testament. He reveals his will through the holy books, through the scriptures. And we disagree on which scriptures, but the fact that he gives his word to people and that word is written down is something that we share. He is the creator of all things, and his creation includes the earth, people, paradise, hell, and angels. Satan is around and is a creature. These are aspects that are shared. He expects his people to obey him and his will to spread the message he has given to all people. So the Muslims are evangelical too. And they and these books that I have here, this book, which must be very expensive to print, it was given to me by a student, and it was compliments of Al Raji Company for currency exchange and commerce. Al Raji Company was the kind of the common bank that we all went to have our money exchanged from rials, the currency of Saudi Arabia, into dollars. So they pay for this kind of thing. And so does the government of Saudi Arabia. The government of Saudi Arabia encourages people to come every year for the Hajj. They set up tents. They have a whole cabinet-level position within their government to take care of this Hajj every year. And that position is a prestigious one. To communicate with other Islamic countries, and they're very proud of that. So the scriptures and all that is very important, and they want to spread that word out. And they're active in the United States. I saw recently in the Chronicle of Higher Education, kind of a trade bulletin for people in colleges, that there's a King Fahd seat of Islamic studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Now, I would bet that has been a chair that was endowed by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I know that there are other seats of Islamic scholarship, and so they're very interested in expansion. And they have expanded, of course, over the centuries, as we have. He will reward and punish all people on the Day of Judgment. Very strong on this. There are passages in the Quran of paradise and eternal punishment. God is all-powerful and all-knowing, and his will and purpose will be accomplished. Very strong on that. God is distinct from his creation. He is transcendent, but his people can talk to him in prayer. And they are much stronger, and I'm sure the average Muslim prays more than the average Christian does, at least 5 times a day, or at least the sincere one does. He is merciful and forgiving, as well as being just. What it teaches about man is responsible to God for his actions. He will be judged at the end of history. He sins in his weakness and should seek forgiveness from God. He is a creature of God, but one with special dignity as God's representative in the world. So, and I've already kind of gone through the points about Jesus that are here. And so I've talked for a while, and I'll try to answer some questions if I can. I'll pretty much end my presentation there. Yeah?
How young can you be when you go to Mecca? I mean, what is the age?
How young? Carol, do you have?
Go to Hajj.
Yeah.
I think any Muslim people. I think they bring children home.
When they go through the rites, though.
I don't think they would go, certainly before puberty, because that's when they start fasting. Carol had some students. Maybe you want to talk about a couple of your students who started. It's kind of along the same lines of development in the religion. You had one student who was real, and these were sixth grade?
Just that I taught sixth grade, and by that age, the students, the Muslim students, really started to be excited about fasting for the whole month of Ramadan, like their parents. Fasting meaning they don't eat or drink anything from sunrise to sunset, and then at night they feast a lot and have parties and family gatherings. But the problem was, I was in an American school, we didn't take Ramadan into consideration with our schedule, so these children had to be out in the hot sun at PE, at living out the day while their parents maybe could be home resting. So, but quite a few of them would start out fasting, but not very many made it to the end of the month, maybe one or two. But you could tell it was very exciting for them. Now they were being like their parents, much like our children, get excited.
A rite of passage.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And the one boy did finish, didn't he? He made it to the end?
One year, yeah.
Yeah. As far as going to Mecca, I think probably the usual time when they would go, and my students, of course, being in Saudi Arabia, went more than once in their lifetime, would probably be high school or college age. But through the centuries, this pilgrimage to Mecca has been a monumental thing that one would save up for a lifetime to be able to go. I mean, you can imagine the average Indian in the subcontinent, thousands of miles away from Mecca, having to go either by ship or across land, and having to pay for that all, often to mercenaries, and that became a real point of honor. It became a point of honor both if one returned and didn't return. If you didn't return, if you died in Mecca, that was the ultimate way to go. If you recall, and it still is, a couple of years ago, a number of people were, or was it just last year? A couple of years ago, a number of people were killed in Mecca when the Iranians had a riot there, started a riot. But just last year, I think it was, a tunnel collapsed. Totally a structural problem, having nothing to do with political things. And tens, dozens, if not over hundreds, were killed in Mecca, and the response of the king was, "It's Allah's will." And they were in Mecca at the time. What a better place for a Muslim to die. So it wasn't like, "Gee, I'm sorry, we're ready to pay recompense." So that is a monumental thing. And again, you maybe had more experience of this talking about. I tried to stay off the religion topic with my students because it was viewed very suspiciously, but Carol had a little more freedom over at the American Academy. The one teacher you knew, maybe you should tell that, Carol?
Just that there was a teacher there, she was actually Filipino and had married an Indian Muslim, so she changed then her religion. She was a Christian before. So she had gone on the Hajj, and to listen to her tale was an exciting, the thought of 4 million people coming together in one place and from all over the world, and having to circle this stone, the Kaaba. And she said at one time there would be 150,000 people circling that stone, but it was just a hushed muffle. You wouldn't hear anything because everybody was so silent. She said it was a very, very stirring experience. And then there were all sorts of other rituals that they had to perform, and being that numbers are now up to 4 million, some of them create quite a problem. For instance, she said that there's something about having to throw 7 stones in a well for 7 days, something like that. well, 7 times 7 times 4 million, there aren't that many stones around. So she said they literally have a pickup truck sitting at the bottom of the well, and when it fills up with stones, it goes around and scatters them around so people can go up and pick them up and throw them in the next. It's the only way that they can handle that number of people. But it did sound like a very moving experience to be there with, but a very frightening one too. I mean, some are very, very poor people from Indonesia, Malaysia, from India, don't speak a word of Arabic, and feel totally lost in there. She said often you would see these poor women just clinging on to their husband or a leader because they were so fearful of getting separated and never finding them again.
Huh. Did you see that movie about the American woman married to a Muslim? I think it was in Iran, and they went back on a holiday with their little girl.
No, a couple
and
of people have mentioned it.
Yeah. I was going to get a reaction to that.
I think what she's referring to is a movie, and this has happened in Saudi Arabia as well as in Iran. There's a book called At the Drop of a Veil about a woman who marries a young, tall, dark, and handsome, dashing fellow over here. He assures her everything's going to be wonderful. They fall in love. They have children. They go back for one reason, a holiday, or they go back to live. And then they find out that they're captive, basically, and that they can't get out. And in that case, I think, and in this other case in Saudi Arabia, the woman ends up kidnapping her own children to get them out of the country. I'm sure that happens, of course. Spouse abuse, child abuse happens in our own country too. Not to justify that circumstance. I know that that it's a very, very difficult thing to marry across cultures. And when the cultural barrier is so intense in religion, in roles, in climate, in holidays, in every aspect of our lives, I would think it would be nearly impossible to make a marriage out of it. But lots of people do. We had lots of friends who married. Not so many, we didn't have so many friends who had married Muslims, but we had lots of friends who had married people from other cultures. In fact, in Saudi Arabia, it was kind of a haven for people like that because they could be in neither culture. They were in neutral territory, and they could make a go of it. But you did know, again, you knew some people who had married Muslims and had either converted or not converted, and made a go of it. The biggest shock I got when I was in Saudi Arabia is I had taken Carol to a doctor once, and I took our kids off to a playground, and one of my kids was on a swing, and the other one wanted to go on the slide, and I had just started the one on the swing. And so Jenny said, "Daddy, Daddy, help me on the slide." And I said, "Just a minute, just a minute. I'm going to push Kristen." And I was pushing her. And this woman in a black veil was standing there. Well, the usual thing is that you're never, ever supposed to talk to a Saudi woman. I mean, you just treat her as though she did not exist. And that's not really so unusual in the Middle East is, for example, when you're shopping, if you don't want to be bothered by the people who are hawking their wares, is you just treat them as they don't exist. Although it seems rude to us, that's the culture and tradition there. And even looking at a woman is seen to be an infringement on her territory. Anyway, so I just had totally ignored this woman there, and so I was pushing my one child and just about to go over and help Jenny on the slide. And this woman says, in the thickest Brooklyn accent I think I've ever heard, "You go ahead, and I'll push the other one." And I said, "Well, okay." And so we got to talking. And she was an American who had married a Saudi and was completely happy with her life, had no wish to go back to New York. And maybe we can say, "Yeah, New York." I don't want to go to New York.
Don't even care.
Yeah. Uh-oh. Actually, I went to New York this year, and I turned out to like it. But anyway, she said that she knew lots of Americans who had come to Saudi Arabia and had made their peace with it and liked it, and they were a support group for one another. Now, it shocked me that she would fit into that culture and completely subjugate herself, not have a... didn't shock me so much that she wouldn't have a career. There are some women in this country who don't have careers, per se, but outside of the home. But it was more that they... that, you know, she didn't view as she had lost anything at all. In fact, it gained a lot. And the one thing that she really worried about was her son and having to grow up in that culture, because she saw it as a culture controlled by the women, oddly enough. And that once he got married, he would be controlled by his wife. And it was a really interesting conversation. I came away from it feeling like, there's a combination of things happening here. There's a one thing, maybe she's self-deluding herself. secondly, maybe I'm deluding myself and I need to listen more to the other side of it. And there's more than one way to look at a situation. Other questions?
Does the God of Islam have a nurturing side to him or it?
Yes, I would think so. It's not expressed in the same way. They talk continually about God being merciful. But I think they would think it's silly to do things like pray Abba, Ima, Papa, Mama. You know, to think of God as a real personal comforting kind of thing. It's kind of like God is there, He's created the world, this is the world and the way it is, and you kind of fit in. And also, you know, in the sense of the sin is a real interesting thing. It's like they can sin, but then they do their prayers and their rituals, and that's all over with. It's not so much the forgiveness and the sacrifice and all of that we have in the Christian tradition, which is interesting in that it's in the sense of being more Middle Eastern. I think of Islam as a more Middle Eastern religion, even though Christianity is very much a Middle Eastern religion that's come to us through Europe. But it doesn't have that sacrificial aspect to it in terms of
forgiveness. Is there a prayer five times a day, the same prayer?
Essentially, yes. I don't think they make up their own prayers. It's very ritualistic. And there are, you've seen them, I'm sure, on television and in movies, there are motions that one goes through in doing it. I mean, the way you hold your hands before the prayer, you wash every time to cleanse yourself. And going through the prayer, there's a leader, not a priest, but just a leader of the group, he will lead one through the motions of the prayer. And they have a sermon in their service, too. Muhammad gave many sermons during his lifetime.
Mm-hmm. What is necessary for them to get to their heaven? I mean, do they just have to do these rituals?
It's the five pillars of Islam. There's not a sense, I've never seen or heard of a sense of believing, you know, like in the sacrifice of Christ or accepting Jesus as your Savior kind of concept. It's basically to say, I mean, if you want to convert after today, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is His prophet. And that's, and you believe that, if you really believe that, then you are a Muslim, and you are with God, and you will see paradise. Now, there are also the other pillars of Islam. The profession is the first. The tithing, they're supposed to give 5% of their income, the going to Mecca, the prayer five times a day, and the holy month of Ramadan. And I think a person is judged, and your good deeds and your bad deeds are counted up and weighed on the final judgment day. So there's not just like one saving thing of believing, and then that's it. Mm-hmm.
Is there a common part in Muslim religion to
Yes, very much. There is the giving of your 5% of your income to the poor.
To the poor.
To the poor. Yeah, not to the church.
Not to the church.
No, to the poor. And there are Islamic societies. There is not a Red Cross, as you might imagine. There's a Red Crescent in Islam. for distributing to the poor and the needy. So there is that sense.
In this recent disaster in Bangladesh, King Fahad gave a huge amount of money. I can't remember how many millions of dollars it was, and I think that's fairly typical.
Would they have in any of their teachings or any of their books teachings of Jesus about that? Would that have been a message of Jesus within the Muslim religion? Or
I don't think that, well, there may be. There isn't so much the words of Jesus that I've read in the Quran, and I haven't read all of it by any means, but it's more or less about Jesus, you know, his role and his immaculate conception.
Role of Jesus saying things like that, or would it be totally different?
I think they see that as a tradition of the prophets, and indeed it is a tradition of the prophets, of not ignoring the poor among you and so on.
Churches?
They have mosques, and they vary a lot from Islamic country to Islamic country. They have no pews inside. There is supposed to be a beautiful array of carpets that one kneels down on and performs the prayers. Kneel, stand, sit, and at different times during the prayers. Inside the mosque, there are no symbols. This is the religion of absolute purity, so there's no symbols, there's no idols. There's only an archway in the direction of Mecca, and everyone prays in that direction.
Is this not also true that in their artwork there are no figures, there's no faces?
That's right.
It's all geometric design.
That's right, and particularly in Saudi Arabia, yeah. They make carpets, and as you are familiar with, the carpets are very geometric and beautiful and intricate. And another thing that they do a lot in their artwork, they're very proud of their calligraphy, their handwriting, and they embellish the words of the Quran in beautiful designs with flowing script, gorgeous things.
How about television? I mean, that's a representation. I mean, how can they allow that anymore?
Well, television has a kind of questionable role in the Gulf. Let my wife and I display a Saudi kiss as it's portrayed on Saudi TV, if we may. There's no touching between the sexes. I'm trying to find these pages.
They say, though, that wasn't it the first radio when they wanted to make a radio broadcast?
I said that, yeah.
Oh,
yeah, before you came in, yeah.
And I'm sure the same thing is true with television, that they do have, they have a prayer intermission. During prayer time, all you see across the screen is prayer intermission for 20 minutes, little colored lights going on. And they do recite the Quran, so maybe that's how they got it going, by saying, well, it can be used for good purposes.
So they do tell it like that, huh?
Oh yeah.
Are there
Western
movies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but fairy sets are just
they're very very moralistic and very careful about a lot of this stuff. I have a few things that I took from Saudi Arabia while I was there, circulars and so on that were handed out to us. They have a group that is generally known as the Mutawa, or the Public Morality Branch, or another name which I just love, is the Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice.
Sounds like the Methodists. Isn't there a moral code, or a code of ethics, come from the Quran?
It's teachings of Muhammad. He certainly had prohibitions against alcohol and pork and women. But, for example, with women, the thing in the Quran is said that a woman shall be her dress shall be modest when she goes abroad, meaning outside of the home. Now, in Saudi Arabia, they've taken that to the ultimate extreme with this abaya cloth that covers the woman, and in the very religious people, they put on black wool gloves and socks so that no flesh at all can be seen. So that you really have a sense, I always referred to it as a black hole in space. It's just kind of this non-entity among you. And I really got to resent that. There was a woman who lived above us. We had an apartment house, and her husband lived above us. And she came from Algeria. And oddly enough, it was much harder sometimes for Muslim women coming from other countries because they weren't viewed as being holy enough. And every time I came out of my house, it seemed, for a while, this woman was coming down the stairs next to mine. And naturally, when you hear a noise next to you, you turn and look. And inevitably, that woman was there, and she would just yank down her veil. And I felt like, oh, you know, what have I tried to do to this lady? I felt like a molester or something just because I looked at her. And it got to be quite disconcerting. I wanted to read the thing about Omaha. Oh, yes. Here it is. This is, again, from the Organization for Enjoying the Good Action and Forbidding the Evil Action. It is very noticeable that some non-Muslims in this country have been thinking impure thoughts about alcoholic beverages and funny sex things with women other than their lawful wives. This is an evil action which is not in consistency with the directions of our Islamic religion, nor with the customs, characteristics, and habits of this pure country. It is afraid, or we are afraid, that these bad habits will transfer to the Muslim youth bound for the outer world, which will have a great effect on declining the youth, spoiling their behaviors, and being far from their noble Islamic directions and characters. Are any of you from Omaha, Nebraska? Oh, maybe you can tell me then. It says here, already it is noticed more and more that our spoiled youth applying for visas, because they often will travel outside the country, to Bangkok, Manila, Omaha, and other such abodes of debauchery. What is it about Omaha, Nebraska? Please tell me.
He wanted a woman for the 5-year stay in America, and he said, I have a car, an apartment, and lots of money. He wanted me to get the daughter of some host family to move in with him and understand why I was
That's debauchery, yes, yeah, it
that
is.
Only happens in the attitude is what she did with a non-believer. I mean,
exactly, right. Yes. Yes, and there is that dichotomy. I mean, they're very, in the Islamic mind, they're able to draw that dichotomy, which we see as hypocrisy, but they see as consistency, and as long as it's not with Muslims. And it's infuriating at times, but again, that's another way of looking at things. And of course, that's going to create bad feelings, and I'm sure you were insulted by that. How did you deal with that?
Well,
mm-hmm.
And they would go home and they'd watch their television to learn English. And
yeah.
They'd look at the, go to the movies to learn
yeah.
English. And they got the concept of American culture and what American women were willing to do from the movies and the television.
Yeah.
And some of them could be in 6 months and never have been in an American home or been exposed to an American family. It was all through the television.
That's true around the world too.
Yeah.
The idea of people out of America is.
Yeah. And it's reinforced by this kind of thing, consistently. So I suppose when they come here, they're going to try it out. They're not the only young men who try out sexual impurity, others are a lot more subtle or endearing about it, maybe. But. So I guess that's the end of our time. But I have some of these things if you'd like to look at them. And
I'll take one back home.
It's a kick, let me tell you. Thank you very much.